This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Do you know how to type? For many of us, typing was taught at school, mainly to women who planned on becoming secretaries. Men didn't know or need to know how to type. They just needed to know how to dictate to women who knew how to type. But so much has changed. We used keyboards now more than ever. But like me, are you a two-finger typer? Do your kids know how to type? I mean, typing is now not a standalone subject at school. Keyboarding is that, but that's sort of just morphed into general computer studies. So is being able to type well still important? And how well can you type? And also coming up this hour, do you ride a motorbike and how worried are you about potholes?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Do you know how to type? Do your kids know how to type? It's not being taught at schools anymore. It's sort of just morphed into keyboarding, just a part of computer studies. But is being able to type really well still important? Is it a skill that we need? And maybe should it come back as a standalone subject as well? Linda's in Glenroy. Hi, Linda.
Good morning.
How are you at typing?
I think I'm pretty good at typing. I did it at business school on the old typewriters, and I've kept it going for decades. I unfortunately dropped shorthand, which I wish I'd kept up for taking notes and the like, but I actually use my typing for taking minutes.
And how many words per minute? Because that's what it was all about, was how many words per minute you can do.
I was very good. I was around the 80 mark.
Wow.
And as a side note, my father, decades ago, was an office person at the mines in Broken Hill, and his shorthand and his typing were phenomenal. And when he left, they had to put two more staff on.
Oh, wow. See, this is the interesting thing. It's not taught anymore. I'm a shocking typer, and a lot of people in my generation are quite good at it, especially those who wanted to go to business school or women who are a little older than me who thought they wanted to become secretaries because it was just seen as a good, secure job. When I watch people type really well, I think, wow, they must save so much time, and I'm kind of plodding along with my two fingers. Well, some research has been done into the fact that kids don't know how to type, and we'll speak to one of the researchers in just a moment. But Barbara's in Brighton. Morning, Barbara.
Oh, good morning.
Is it important to know how to type well, do you think?
I think it's really important. And I really feel they teach schools. I learned at school. I went to high school in the 50s. I did 3 years of time and shorthand, and they've been successful. And when my boys started high school, I sent them during holidays to actually do a typing course. And I liked it at the time because it was holidays, but they didn't thank me now.
Barbara, it's not a great line, so I'll say goodbye, but thank you. And I just wonder whether it is starting to be introduced because we're seeing how vital the skill is, especially now that we text so often, or if you use an iPad, you know, that the keyboard on that, if it's not a standalone keyboard, if it's one that you use on the screen, you certainly can't type on that. But then there's a text here from Ben who says, Rish, my kids are getting to the end of grade 2 and grade 4. They've both received extensive typing training. This is at a regional private school. Once they get their pen license, they have to work towards their computer license. Each semester, they have to achieve a word per minute level in order to progress. I wonder whether or not your school is doing the same thing. Is typing important? Do you know how to type, or do you wish you knew how to type? Deborah Pino-Pasternak is a professor in early childhood education and community at the University of Canberra. And Deborah, you've been a part of a nationwide study that's looking at computer-based writing skills. Is it still seen as an important and as a necessary skill to be able to type well and properly?
Thanks, Rochelle, for having me. It's a pleasure to be speaking about this study. Learning to type is an essential skill for all the reasons that your listeners have mentioned. It's important in the workplace. It is important to create efficiencies in the way we communicate and to be able to communicate our thinking through, you know, text, through emails, through written documents. Now, our survey not only looked at keyboarding, it also looked at the teaching of word processing skills. So do you understand Word? Do you know how to save a document, edit a document? Do you know the functionality of the platforms that allow us to write in a computer?
There's so many texts saying, I was told to do it, I didn't want to do it at the time, but now I am so glad that I know because it helps me in so many different ways. Here's just one of them. It says, morning, Rish, I'm an occupational therapist. I've worked in aged care as an assessment clinician for the last 12 years. More than ever, I rely on my touch typing. I'm beyond grateful to my teacher, Mrs. Hawke, for insisting that I should learn. I could not do the volume of work for my job that it requires if I could not touch type. Do you think the average person finishing, let's say year 12, knows how to touch type?
Look, that is outside the scope of our research, but experientially, I think I would be safe to argue that probably they don't. You know, what Ben was saying about what's happening in that particular school where children need to acquire a sort of a keyboarding license is fantastic, but it's not standard practice in the schools. And the variability is an issue that we have examined across Australia. What your listeners are saying, that I totally agree, is that knowing how to touch type improves your automaticity. You really don't have to think where the letters of the keyboard are. And that frees your working memory in your brain to really think, what is it that I want to say? How do I want to say it? How do I engage my audience? If I'm focusing on the pecking movement, which is the one you were describing, you do, there is a lot of your attention and brain power that is invested just in locating the keys in the keyboard.
When did we start to phase out teaching it as a standalone subject?
Well, I would argue, and actually our work argues, that keyboarding and word processing should be integrated in our literacy lessons because it's one modality of written communication. I do think that there needs to be dedicated time for practice and for developing that automaticity, and maybe some dedicated time for that needs to happen. But part of the problem that we identified in our survey is that there is a mutual delegation of who's responsible. Is it the tech teacher? Is it the English teacher? So we need to, our position is that as writing is an integrated activity, we need to embed it in our literacy sessions. But at the same time, there needs to be standalone time for systematic and regular practice.
There's so many different texts on this. Suzanne says, I started high school in 1987. Touch typing was still compulsory in year 7 and 8, which was great because I can still touch type now 100 words per minute. Wow. Oddly enough, they cancelled touch typing a few years later, even when they introduced compulsory laptops for all students starting in year 7. It's not a natural skill, but it also helps with going on to playing musical instruments. Others saying that their parents, my mum sent me for typing lessons at 14. It's the best thing ever. They went on to be an editor, worked at places like the Lonely Planet, and they offered touch typing training to other people within their work environment. But Eric says it's now all voice to text and AI. No typing is required. Is Eric right? I mean, are we seeing that it's just not as important anymore because we can use AI and voice to text?
Look, I don't think typing will go anywhere anytime soon. And let me speak about these technologies as voice to text, but also AI. Voice to text is an incredible adaptation for people and individuals that require special, you know, adaptations in their environment to be more productive. But if you look at the majority of workplace and what's happening in schools, it's still through keyboarding activity. Now, in reference to AI, there is a huge risk in the notion of delegating our thinking to a language model like ChatGPT. We need to support our children in becoming expert writers so they can collaborate with AI, maybe as editing partners and seeking feedback from AI on the quality of the writing. But writing is a thinking activity. It's a multidimensional activity, and our neurological studies show that there are several areas of the brain that become activated when we write, and we don't want to basically not to give that opportunity to our students to develop that learning.
So if you're spending most of your time, like me, figuring out where the letters on the keyboard are and plotting along with two or three fingers, then your brain is focused on that as opposed to being creative. Stay with us. Deborah Pino-Pasternak is with you, a professor in early childhood education from the University of Canberra. We're talking about the skill of typing and touch typing. Is it still needed? Is it still important? Jenny's in Lilydale. Hi, Jenny.
Oh, hi there. I just want to make the point that all NAPLAN testing, standardised testing, is done online. So children and young people are required to type, and their ability to type will directly affect their NAPLAN results.
How well do you type, Jenny?
Oh, not that well.
No.
I can type, but yeah, no, I don't touch type. I absolutely agree that writing with your hand is vital, but also, I mean, if you're going to rate schools and rate children on their NAPLAN results, and that's directly involved with typing, well, that's something to be considered.
There's nothing more impressive than watching someone who is just an awesome typer, and you could imagine that they would be getting through five times the amount of work that you are, and you're not going back and checking things and fixing things as well. Jenny, thank you. Let's go to another Jenny in Port Arlington. Hi, Jenny.
Oh, hi, Rish. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sort of wishing I could type, though. I'm embarrassingly bad. How are you, Jenny?
Yeah, good, thank you. I've got a hot tip for you, Rich.
Yeah.
You have to know where the home keys are.
Yeah.
And if you sit your fingers on the home keys with your left hand and your right hand, which for your left hand that's ASDF, and on the right hand I think it's JKL, if you sit your fingers there and then type everything from there, it's much easier.
And was that something you were taught in high school, Jenny?
It was. I went to high school in the late 70s and early 80s, and yes, I was taught. And I did work as an academic professionally, so it was very helpful to me.
And do you think it is still helpful? I mean, as we do move to voice to text, do you think we need it?
Yes. Yes, I you know, I'm always constantly at my laptop every day writing stuff, so I find it really helpful.
Well, Jacinta Parsons outed me last week with the state of my keyboard, so maybe I can't type because my keyboard is full of crumbs and food and it's it's disgusting. Anyway, that's a conversation for another day. Jenny, thank you. Deborah, is this something that you think we will see change, that schools will start to look at how important it is, that it is still needed depending on the sort of job that you want to do, the sort of direction you want to take later in life? I mean, we've got everyone from English teachers to people who are small business owners that are saying, yeah, it's really important.
Well, that's actually a change we would like to see. At the moment, there's really little knowledge about, you know, evidence-based practice that support keyboarding. There are interesting studies coming out. I think for the same reasons that, you know, your first Jenny listener was saying, because NAPLAN is actually delivered now online, Schools obviously are concerned about their NAPLAN scores, and hopefully that will be an impetus to bring these skills back as formal elements of instruction. The other issue to point with NAPLAN is that all spell checkers, all predictive text that goes with Word documents becomes removed in the NAPLAN environment. So it's absolutely essential for students to practice their basic writing skills in computer-based text, so their spelling, their punctuation, their grammatical structures. So typing is not just the mechanics, the fluency of the keyboarding is about reinforcing the written aspects of language, the foundational skills and language that students require to write well.
Deborah, thanks for your insights. You've invoked a lot of memories for a lot of people. Deborah Pino-Pasternak, Professor in Early Childhood Education and Community at the University of Canberra. Darren's in Parkdale and he says, I'm a 63-year-old man and I learnt to type at school in the 70s from Mrs. Carpenter at Bayswater High School. My work requires emails and reports. I've freaked out younger colleagues by being able to type whilst not looking at the keyboard and listening to a conversation. I know that's always very impressive. Eleanor's in Cheltenham. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. Well, I learned to touch type on the old typewriters when I was 16, and I can still touch type. I'm 91 years old now. And when I was overseas, I had a marvellous job at the Toronto Star newspaper, and I could type 100 words a minute.
Wow.
On an electric typewriter. But that's a long time ago. So now.
And it's almost a bit of a lost skill now, Eleanor. Do you think it's important for, I guess, people who are going through high school now to know how to touch type?
Most definitely. Look, I see people on television, prominent people fiddling along with one finger or even writing these days. When I was 5 years old, I was learning to do sort of really nice writing and continued on. I'm a calligrapher now. But I think the way these young people hold their pen is disgusting. It looks as though they're crippled.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something else in that handwriting. That's a conversation for another day as well. Eleanor, thank you. You can get those calls and texts coming through. And also coming up a little later this hour, if you ride a motorbike, are you a part of a growing number of motorcyclists who are just fed up and really sick of potholes? How much of an issue are they causing you when you're either commuting or you're going for long rides? And when we think about potholes, there's how they impact us when we're in a car, but how different is it when you're in a motorbike? That's coming up a little later this hour as well.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So are you going to Lady Gaga? She has touched down in Australia. And Lady Gaga, well, she just continues to connect with fans. She's been speaking really openly about everything from bullying to her own mental health. She's a huge advocate and ally for the LGBTIQ plus community. So are you going Gaga for Gaga? And also, the message that she puts across. What is it that you love about Lady Gaga? If you're heading to see her, I've got friends who have said, hands down, it is the best concert that they have ever been to. Even up against Madonna, Kylie, you name it, that Gaga is the best. So are you heading to see her when she's here in Melbourne? Dr. Kat Nelligan is a lecturer in popular culture and music at RMIT. Kat, you're a Gaga fan. She just
absolutely,
can,
I am.
So am I. And it's something about her as well as her music. It's how she speaks up, speaks out, how she reinvents herself, how vulnerable she is, how open she is. What is it about Lady Gaga for you that just connects to so many people who quite often feel like they're not represented in any way?
Yeah, these are really good questions. I mean, the music is a big part of it, of course. I think people really enjoy the way Lady Gaga can put together a song that brings you know, people's happiness out. You can dance, you can sing along, all those usual things that, that pop music does for people. But more importantly, I think it's the messages that she sends, mostly to everybody, but mostly to her fans, her super fans. That is her collective of little monsters. Now, that's something she's been doing since the very early stages of her career. She's been a superstar for almost 2 decades now. Mm. And very early on, she would encourage her fans to have self-love, self-acceptance, to be proud of who they are, to be brave, to accept the things about themselves that make them different and unique. And she said to people, basically, if you're a little, if you feel different and you feel a bit like an outcast from society, then that's okay. I see you, I value you, you're important, and those things actually make you beautiful. And they're timeless messages. They're the sorts of messages that are, you know, really positive and good for people. And I think this has really shaped the connection she has with her fans.
And I feel like she takes that role very seriously, to be there, you know, for the little monsters, as she says. If you feel like an outcast, if you feel different, if you feel like such an individual that you don't belong, that it's okay. You know, you belong with me,
yes,
and I will represent,
yes,
you. I will stand up for you.
That's right. Yes, and that's exactly, you hit it on the head there with the idea of belonging. I mean, I think it's a very human thing to want to belong and to feel like we belong. And Gaga sort of cultivates that for people, and cultivates that in particular for these fans who have at different points in their lives felt marginalized or felt like they don't quite belong. So she's given them that sense of belonging. And again, that sort of, that message is carried carried through, and so it's definitely something I've connected to.
Yeah, absolutely. And for 2 decades now, it's hard to believe that it's been that long. Are they the same fans that are growing up with her, or is she still attracting new and younger fans?
Yeah, look, I think it's like any pop star, in the sense that I think she'll always have, you know, fans that are going to stick by her right from the beginning, right through. I'm sure there's also fans who don't necessarily relate to what she does now or like the music that she does. But on the same token, I feel like she would have absolutely have picked up some new fans. To give you an example, I'm heading to the concert this Saturday. Pretty excited to see her perform at Marvel Stadium in Melbourne. And I'm taking my mum and I'm taking my niece. So there's three generations.
That.
Yeah, there's three generations right there.
What are her shows like? I've got friends who love all of, I was going to say divas, but you know what I'm talking about. They love Madonna and Kylie and go to all of those big showgirl, Taylor, you name it, and have said, hands down, Gaga is the best concert they've ever been to, and there was something about her energy and the way that she performed that just made her stand out.
Yeah, look, I'll let you know after Saturday. This is my first time seeing her live, but I've heard pretty much the same thing, in the sense that, I mean, I think her shows are quite diverse, in the sense that she brings a theatricality to her shows. She brings, you know, costuming, really elaborate stage props, really elaborate dance routines and dances on stage. And I think that is quite, it's really visually spectacular. But then she'll also, at different points in the concert, sort of strip all that back and just sit at the piano, because, you know, this is how she started off with her music career, really, was just sort of playing piano, singing. In fact, it was a lot of playing classical pieces when she was, say, 4 or 5 years old. But she's got that ability to be able to put on that spectacular show visually and even from a sound perspective, but then strip it all back and just let people sort of enjoy the singer-songwriter part of her identity and part of her songwriting career.
And the woman can act as well. Like, do you think that we'll see her on the screen more often? I mean, she's just incredible to watch.
Yes, I think we will. One of the things about Gaga is that she always wanted to be an actor. So if you look at any of the media interviews she's done, or wherever she's talked about, you know, her aspirations and the dreams she had growing up, music was one, but mostly she was interested in acting and being in films. So I think we'll definitely see more of that. I feel like that part of her career's really only just, you know, kicked off.
Absolutely. I love that you're taking your mum and that you're taking your niece Kat to see Lady Gaga when she's in Melbourne this weekend. I could imagine there's going to be some pretty awesome outfits in the audience, depending on the two decades and which era you might want to attach yourself to. Have you thought about what you're going to wear?
Oh, goodness. I'm actually feeling quite intimidated because I know there's like, yeah, there's a lot of effort. Little monsters go to a lot of effort to, I think it's actually called method dressing. They dress up like her. They mimic a lot of her outfits. At this point, I've got a Lady Gaga, a T-shirt in mind. I'm more of a T-shirt and jeans sort of a girl, so... I might just lean on my sort of casual credentials there.
I love it. Kat, have the best time. Thank you. Dr. Kat Nalligan, a lecturer in popular culture at the music industry of RMIT. Are you going to Gaga mixes? My 21-year-old daughter went to AC/DC with a 60-year-old dad and now is going to Gaga with her mum. I love it.
Stay with me. I love it. Love game, intuition, play the cards with spades to start. And after he's been hooked, I'll play the one that's on his heart.
We've also been talking about touch typing. Did you learn how to type in high school? Is it just a skill that is falling by the wayside as we've got voice to text now? Is it being taught at your kids' school? 1-300-222-774. And why is it important now? Doug's in Warrnambool. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Rochelle. Thanks for taking my call.
No worries. Can you type?
Look, I can type. I learned in year 9 when I was at a school in Gippsland in Maule, Kurnai College now, Maryvale High School.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so we're doing, we had to do woodwork, cooking, sewing,
and typing it all back.
Something that everyone had to do.
See, the boys didn't have to do typing at my school, Doug.
No, I think our school was a little bit different in that regard, and everyone had to do those four areas in year 9 and 10. So, yeah, it's really, really quite good.
I remember the boys did, this shows you just how old-fashioned it was and how gendered it was. The boys did woodwork and the girls did typing. Oh, far out. Well, that's bad, isn't it?
When I started teaching, they were still doing that in the new school I went to in Western Victoria. The girls were doing typing, the boys were doing woodwork and metalwork.
And do you like that you can type and type well, Doug?
Look, it's been really good. It's something I've sort of taken for granted, actually, Rochelle. Just another typing story. My mother-in-law, now sadly deceased, she was a champion typist and she typed 170 words a minute and was a Victorian champion.
What? How is that even possible?
She had another claim to fame because she went from office work into being the typing teacher at Caulfield High School, and from there she started work experience.
What? So she started the concept?
Yeah. She had girls that she was teaching in year 11 that she thought would need skills in office work as well as typing. And so she went into the places that she used to work and found placements for her year 11 girls. And then from that she was on a steering committee to start work experience throughout Victoria in a whole lot of trades.
Oh, my goodness. I have never even thought of the idea that an individual came up with the idea of work experience.
Yeah, well, she saw it as a niche for the typing. This is Thelma Bell I'm talking about. Thelma saw it as a niche that she knew that the girls would benefit from, and then they thought, well, why stop at girls and typing? Why not go further afield? And now we've got kids doing plumbing, you name it.
What an incredible family story you have, Doug.
Yeah, well, it's not the good side of us family, not the bad side.
Well, I mean, there'll be lots of people that are going on work experience, are thinking about work experience, who, you know, have your mum to thank for that. Doug, thank you. Where are we? Marcia's in Massenden. Morning, Marcia.
Hi, how are you, Rochelle?
Really well. What do you want to say?
I learned to type it when I was at boarding school from age 11. And
I never thought I was, I wasn't the slightest bit interested in becoming a typist. But, yeah, little did I know that it would become such a life skill.
So how do you use it and when do you use it?
Well, I'm now retired, but I used it at work, working in a early intervention and writing up notes and really quick to be able to touch type when you're just thinking about what you're typing, what you want to type rather than the actual process of it.
Yeah, and it just saves you so much time as well, doesn't it? Thank you, Marcia. Michael says, hey, Rish, you've had 2 decades to go and do woodwork. Did you have a crack? I actually did do it at school because I said it's not fair that just the boys do it. I want to do woodwork as well. And I made a really dodgy egg container. It was terrible. I was really bad at woodwork, but I had to stick it out because I'd made such a fuss that the girls weren't allowed to do woodwork. So I had to do a whole semester of it. Coming up in just a moment, if you're a motorcyclist, how problematic are potholes? How concerned are you about potholes?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So we know that potholes are a huge concern for many of us, especially if you're driving on regional and country roads or late at night, or even maybe just on the Nepean or on one of the highways. But imagine for a moment that you're on 2 wheels as opposed to 4, and that your protection is simply the clothing that you're wearing. How much of a difference does that pothole make to your safety? Well, there is a growing concern within the Victorian motorcycle community about the risk of potholes, so much so that they do plan on protesting about it early in the new year. Rob Salvatore is the chairman of the Victorian Motorcycle Council. Rob, I know where all the potholes are on my commute to work. For example, I know which roads to avoid, I know how to swerve, but I'm also worried about the people behind me who don't know where those potholes are and whether or not they're going to hit me. I could imagine as a motorcyclist that fear would be tenfold.
Rochelle, it's fantastic that you are actually concerned about those others that aren't aware. But yes, there is a growing concern and even bordering on outrage within the motorcycling community. We have enough risk factors that we already face, but the condition of Victoria's roads should not be one of them. And if we hit a pothole and it changes that traction picture between our two contact patches in the road, it can end up as a very bad day for us. Absolutely.
So there's texts coming in. There's one here, it says from Grumpy Steve on his bike, and it says, the saddest thing about potholes in our overall road maintenance program is this: the waste of money it creates, particularly on rural roads. It's beyond belief how a road repair team can be paid to travel out to fix these potholes and just ignore the next one and the pothole next to it. Second issue is a waste of funds. It seems that the work is being paid by Vic Roads, but it's never checked, and it's the quality of repair. They only last a couple of weeks, then they have to be paid for and fixed all over again. I've noticed the same thing that Steve, who was a motorcyclist, has said, and it's the same potholes that just reappear and reappear. As soon as it rains, that pothole just, it's there again. It never really goes away. Is that an issue for the motorcyclists, Rob?
It is absolutely an issue. When a pothole is filled and the area around that pothole is not addressed, as soon as it starts raining or a heavy vehicle goes over the top of it again, the edges start to fray and that pothole starts to reform. And that tends to put loose materials on the road at around that location. And again, the traction picture gets interfered with. So I hope we can encourage Minister Horn to negotiate some additional budgets and resources to get these issues fixed in our regional roads.
Rob, stay with us because Josh is in Drysdale. Josh, you're a motorcyclist?
Yeah, Rich, hi.
Hey, how problematic and worrying are they for you?
Oh, really? Like riding even central Geelong, you know. But I've got a friend that his remedy is to get some highly visible white spray paint and paint go around the pothole to draw attention to it, and then as you approach it, to put large crosses on the road.
So you knew where they were.
Yeah, so to know where they were, and hopefully the local Geelong Council will sort of... their conscience will
How long have you been writing, Josh?
Since 1961.
And have they got worse? Are they more common potholes now?
Oh yeah, we wanted to have a surround on the, instead of Victoria the Education State, we wanted to say Victoria the Pothole State.
Wow. And how worried are you about hurting yourself, injuring yourself, or worse?
Well, I always keep a good distance behind the car in front of me so that I can see a pothole coming up. You know, if you ride up, sort of right up close behind a car, you might miss seeing one coming up. So I'm sort of holding my distance back behind the car.
And it must change it in particular that, good on you, Josh, ride safe. Rob Salvatore is with you, Chairman of the Victorian Motorcycle Council. We're talking about just a growing concern within the motorcycle community about the risk that potholes pose to their safety when they are riding. Stephen sends this message and says, riding these days is just tiring, another danger to constantly read. Riding is less enjoyable now. So between people being distracted and in their cars and on phones and potholes, is that a growing issue as well, Rob, that it's just not that enjoyable anymore because you're just constantly trying to read the road?
Well, I'd rather ride than not ride, and riding has many benefits, including cognitive and mental health benefits. But it is so true that out on a regional road, you're dodging potholes, you're reading the road. It does get you more fatigued faster than if it was a well-made road. And Josh was absolutely right, what he's describing in the Geelong area, one of the most popular motorcycling roads just outside of Marysville, has X's and white circles around pothole clusters that haven't been repaired for some time. So there's a grassroots effort to try and help other road users avoid damaging their vehicles or injuring themselves or worse.
Is that being listened to, do you think, that grassroots voice?
I'll acknowledge that the Victorian government and Minister Horne's department, they are aware of this issue and they are dealing with it to a degree, but we need more people. We need more resources. We need this issue to get resolved. It's having an impact on road safety.
Rob, let's have a chat to Peter, who's in Surrey Hills. Hi, Peter.
Oh, hi. Yeah, Richard, been riding motorcycles since about 1980, and I've noticed things have got a whole lot worse. And it's not just like an inconvenience, it's a matter of life or death. Mm. I've been riding up a road towards Broadford, the side road. If I wasn't concentrating and flicked my bike and actually went around a pothole, I reckon I'd have gone into it. It was big enough to toss me off the bike. If you're doing 80 or 100K, I think I was doing 80, you know, that could be the end. So this isn't trivial, and it's like, there's clearly not enough funding going into the maintenance of potholes, but it's not just an edge issue, it's a life or death issue for every motorcyclist.
It's such an ongoing issue as well. I think that must be such a frustrating part of this, Peter. I mean, there's a text here that says, the ancient Romans knew how to fix roads, why can't we? And I'm just often baffled as to why technology in this space hasn't improved, whether it's how we make roads or how we fix roads.
Yeah, look, I don't think it's technology. I think it's all to do with funding and intent. And so we're spending billions on freeways and tunnels, but we're not spending it on basic maintenance. And I've even hit problems on the Calder Freeway. The odd time I'm on a freiway, there was a section there was a couple of hundred metres of disturbed surface, which was enough to actually, again, toss a motorcyclist off.
Gosh, it just sounds frightening, Peter. Look, really, ride safe. 1300 222 774. If you're a motorcyclist, is there a particular area that's really problematic to you? Has it changed how often and how frequently you ride? Has it changed how enjoyable riding a motorbike is if you're constantly trying to navigate where the potholes are? Rob Salvatore is with you, Chairman of the Victorian Motorcycle Council. Is it just money? I mean, in terms of the action that you would like to see taken on this and the growing concern that motorcyclists have, is it as simple as spend more money, or given the change to our climate, given the change to our cars, how big they've become, how many of us drive now, is it as simple as that, Rob?
Well, I was going to make the point that the average weight of cars and vehicles has increased, which has increased the wear and tear on Victoria's roads. But I think it is also a combination of money, but also design standards and repair standards. If a contractor's got a specific job and they've got a certain amount of hours allocated to do a patch repair, that isn't of a sufficient standard for the traffic volumes and the weight of heavy vehicles on those roads. So it's a bit of a complex issue, but it's not an unworkable issue. And so I'm optimistic that in the end we'll get to the right answer, but money standards and repair standards are a real key issue.
This is one of the many texts that's come in. It says, I've begged my partner not to buy a motorbike despite it would mean him getting to work quicker. My late aunt was a quadriplegic for 30 years and I've seen many people in my health professional career with life-changing injuries from riding motorbikes. Even my brother wanted a motorbike up until he became a paramedic 30 years ago. If you don't have the protection, you shouldn't be on the road. It's just so unsafe. This is, I guess, a little side issue as well, but just anecdotal. Sure. Rob, seeing people just not wearing the right gear.
There are great reasons to wear gear, and we are very much about encouragement and education and inducement. If you crash wearing great gear and you survive that crash, your recovery will be half as long as if you crashed without the gear. So we encourage riders to make good choices. And we believe it is a choice, but we ask them to make good choices to wear the best gear than they can. And just as an anecdote, I've been riding for 30 years and my mum still asks me regularly to stop riding. I do this as a passion. I ride to add life to my days and it is a very validating experience. It's like a meditation in many respects. So it adds quality to life. And not only that, it improves congestion on Melbourne's roads. So there's a lot of good reasons to ride. Safety is one that we do need to manage, though. I agree.
Just finally, Rob, coming into summer, we know that there are more motorcyclists on the road than the rest of the year. So for people who are in cars, what would you like them to do to ensure that motorcyclists are safe and to be aware?
Yes, we do need to share the roads together. Safety is a shared responsibility. So it is a hard ask, but I would ask to look twice. Look twice. Riders are more difficult to see because bikes are narrow and it doesn't really have anything to do with conspicuity, but we can have that conversation another time. But look twice. Before you take a movement, before you change lane, before you change direction, turn right across the road, turn left across the road, please look twice.
Rob, thanks so much for your insights.
Thanks,
Rob Salvatore, the chairman of the Victorian Motorcycle Council. 12 minutes away from midday. Good morning. My name's Rochelle. This is The Conversation Hour. You're on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. And we've spoken a lot on this program about plastic and waste in our waterways, the impact that it has on marine life, on habitat, and just on our own health. But I want to introduce you to someone who has gone to extraordinary lengths to raise awareness of the health of our oceans and our waterways. His name is Samuel McLennan, and he's a sailor from Hobart, and he's made a boat using rubbish that he's collected from our oceans, our rivers, and our creeks. And he's sailed that boat successfully, thank goodness, across the Bass Strait. Samuel joins you now. I believe you've made your way to St Kilda. Samuel, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. This is one risky way of throwing a spotlight onto the amount of waste and plastic and rubbish in our waterways.
Thanks, Rochelle. It certainly is, but I feel that the evidence is out there that the state of the environment isn't improving, and it's also a big part of this story in this project is that the state of our environment mirrors the state of our society. And as we know, there's a lot of people out there that are experiencing mental health issues like depression and anxiety. And it's pretty easy to see that the state of our environment is really struggling as well. And so they're mirroring each other.
And what's confronting about the boat that you've created from rubbish is that it's a big boat. This is a hefty vessel that you've created, Samuel. So when we're talking about rubbish and waste that are in our waterways, the fact that you can create something as significant as that and travel across the Bass Strait, it's an absolute, I mean, it is a blight on all of us.
Thank you. It's it was something that I'd never done before, but I understand about possibility, and possibility says that it's possible to build a boat out of rubbish, and it's also possible to travel from Hobart to Sydney via Melbourne. And I was very clear that I'd never done it before and that I didn't know how to do it because I've never done it before. And so everything I did was a guess, and using the knowledge that I've got from my past and my experience from my past, and just treading slowly and softly and gently and working out how to make it across safely.
Wow. So what sort of rubbish, what sort of items did you use in order to make a boat, to make it waterproof, to not sink, to be safe, to be able to navigate?
Yeah, so in southern Tasmania, there's a lot of fish farm debris that's been washing in for decades. And this fish farm debris is, it's this black plastic pipe. And they've found 100-foot lengths of this over in New Zealand. And so I was finding easy 70-foot lengths in the coastline in Tasmania. And sometimes other people had already found it and in their sort of coastal walks, and they donated it to the project when they found out about what I was doing. So there's lots of this black plastic pipe, which the vessel's built out of. And then there's lots of these black buoys, which are like the size of 40-gallon drums. And I've tied them together to create the flotation. And lots of those are the white polyurethane buoys, which are about the size of a soccer ball.
Wow.
I've got about 50 of them strapped underneath the cabin.
That's incredible. So, I mean, did you take on water at any time? Like, did you feel buoyant?
Yeah, the buoyancy is good. I have been out there in some very strong conditions, 50 knots and 7-metre seas.
Oh, my Lord.
And, yeah, that wasn't comfortable.
You'd be really hoping that you'd strap that baby together really well, Samuel.
That's correct. But it took me 2 years to build, and there was a lot of two steps forward, three steps back, as I learned to put the pieces together and as I found more pieces. And I've got a lot of experience on the ocean and in the ocean, and I've been in some very big storms before. And so I was aware of the forces that are out there and the strength of the vessel that I needed to create to combat.
So what did you do prior to this?
So by the age of 30, I'd had over 56 different jobs all around the world. And I'm 48 now, and I've had lots of different skills and experiences all around the world to build up my bag of skills. And for the past 15 years, I've been mentoring people. Been mentoring business owners, and I've built a business and I've sold one, and I've done a lot of personal development as well, because I found myself in a place in life where I didn't think I would be, and I was going broke and having arguments with friends, and I had this anger building up inside of me and this frustration, and I realized that I was at a place in life where I didn't think I would be.
Mm.
And so I started working on myself, because I was being a jerk, I was being an asshole, and I was being jealous, and I wasn't looking after the environment, I wasn't supporting other people with what they were doing, and I had this bitterness, and so I started doing personal development. And after my first personal development course, I had 19 days in a row where I had the best day of my life.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, this is taking it to the extreme, though, Samuel, isn't it? For many of us, if we have those moments, we think, "Oh, I should drink some lemon balm tea." You know, we don't go and build a boat from marine waste and rubbish and sail it across the Bass Strait. I just think it's incredible. Before we hit the news, Samuel McLennan is with you as a sailor and founder of Project Interrupt. If you're in and around the St Kilda area, you'll see the boat, the vessel that he has made from this marine rubbish. What do you want done with not only the boat that you've created? I mean, are you taking it somewhere else, or would you like it to go into some kind of educational space or museum?
All of the above. I'm on my way to Sydney, but the main message is for people to take responsibility and organisations to take responsibility. And there's lots of pointing the finger going on. We point the finger at others, and we're expecting other people to stand up and cause the changes that we want to see. But if we all take responsibility for our relationships with ourselves, with others, and with the environment, if we all just do a little bit, we can come together and we can cause a big change.
Well, it's very impressive, Samuel, and because my brain always goes to food and when and how we're going to eat next, I'm presuming you were solo on this boat. What did you take? Did you take food?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Most of the time, yeah.
Yeah.
Coming across Bass Strait, I had a cameraman with me.
Fair enough. And did you stop to get food? Did you take food? What did you eat?
Yeah, I had some food storage on here, and I stopped at Deal Island in the middle of Bass Strait. And I quickly learned that my cameraman ate like a horse.
More supplies.
We ran out of food, and it was actually a beautiful challenge because there were some boats sailing through at the time, and so we had to get a little bit uncomfortable and paddle over to them with our tail between our legs and say, "Hey, we've kind of run out of food because we've been here for a bit longer than expected, and could we borrow a tin of baked beans?"
Oh, that's a risky food to eat when you're in a small space with another man. Hey, we might keep in contact with you, Samuel, as you travel around. But whilst you're here in Victoria at the moment, you're down at Port Phillip, can people come and see you and talk to you and learn from what you're doing?
Totally, that's correct. Tomorrow I'm sailing off to either Williamstown or Port Arlington.
Yep.
I've got an event tonight at the Royal Melbourne Yacht Squadron from 6:30 p.m. and everyone's welcome.
Wow, good on you. I'm going to pop you back on hold, and we'll keep your details, and we'll have a chat to you, Samuel, as you travel around and as you head off to Sydney.
Thanks for sharing.
Safe sailing. Samuel McLennan, sailor, founder of the Project Interrupt. That boat, that vessel, if you're down in the St Kilda area and you've gone, "That's a weird-looking boat," well, it's because it's been made from marine rubbish, from waste that's gone into our waterways. And Samuel has travelled from Hobart. He's travelled across the Bass Strait and he's heading off now to Sydney as well to raise awareness not only of our mental health but to raise awareness of all of the rubbish and the impact that our waste has on our marine life. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.